Good morning, everyone. So I don't know how many of you know, but all the summer preachers have to do a course a few weeks before we are let loose in the pulpit. David Brown spends kind of half a day with us, sort of talking us through some you know key points about preaching. And one of the things that he says is, you need to get their attention really early in the sermon. You need to grab their attention. So I thought that I would do something really deep and meaningful, or I'd show you something really deep and meaningful. So I'd like to bring up my first slide and ask if anyone can relate to this illustration. Anyone? This is deep philosophy. This is by someone called Edward Monkton, who has a series of greeting cards, which I love. And a friend of mine actually gave me a mug with this illustration on it several years ago, almost 10 years ago. And it still really makes me smile because it's such a great summary of how I feel about life sometimes. Can anyone relate to this? Despite all our best plans, all our best efforts and intentions, there are just some moments when it doesn't make sense. We just can't make head or tail of it. We need an intervention. We need a breakthrough. We need a miracle. And last week, if you were in the 11:30 service, you will have heard Joshua sharing from Mark chapter 4. And we had an opportunity to reflect on some of the things that Jesus had to say in that chapter. Joshua also shared some amazing personal testimonies about how in difficult, low, and confusing times, he's seen God work in his life and in his family's life. And if you weren't here last week for the 11:30 service, I would really recommend that you listen to that podcast. It was really powerful stuff. I'm going to read for us from Mark chapter 5, verses 21 to 43. If you don't have a Bible, I think the hospitality team can bring one around for you. And you'll find this reading on page 952 in the church Bible. This passage is an account of a day in the life of Jesus. He doesn't say much in the passage, but it's an opportunity for us to watch him in action. And I find that some of the things he says sometimes seem inappropriate or strange, but you decide for yourself. Mark chapter 5, verses 21 to 43, page 952. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered round him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she'll be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed round him, and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I will be healed." Immediately, her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once, Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you can ask, who touched me?" But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Overhearing what they said, Jesus told him, "Don't be afraid, just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child's not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately, the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. So this is a day when Jesus meets two people who need an intervention, two people who could relate to that illustration that I showed you from one of my favorite mugs. On this day, Jesus heals a woman with a chronic illness and brings a young girl back to life. It's an account of two stories, one which interrupts another. I believe that these two encounters and the way Jesus behaves and responds to the people involved reveal some basic truths about Jesus' heart towards us. I'd like to share with you some observations about the characters and their actions within these two stories. In verses 22 to 24, we see that the first story is about a senior public figure, a ruler in the synagogue, Jairus, whose daughter is dying. An earnest plea from Jairus results in a response from Jesus. He sets off, intending, it seems, to go directly to the home of Jairus, where a young girl's life is at stake. The agenda is set for the day. Jesus will head over to the house, lay hands on the girl, heal her, and he'll be done in time for dinner and some drinks with his friends later. But as we see in verse 25, that's not how the day pans out. The flow of the day's agenda is interrupted by a second story of a woman who has suffered from a chronic health condition, which caused her to bleed excessively for 12 years. She presses through the crowd, sneaks up, and touches Jesus' clothes. She's sure she needs to do nothing more than this to be healed. This woman has been bleeding since the day Jairus' daughter was born. Now imagine if it was today, Jairus and his wife would be leaving Barnet General Hospital with their lovely bundle of joy, whatever her name was, and this woman could be sitting somewhere else in the hospital with some consultants, talking to them about this condition that she didn't understand, and she didn't know that this was the beginning of 12 years of suffering. Discomfort, confusing diagnoses, ineffective treatments, social exclusion, and shame. And although this woman and this girl do not know each other, and though in the 12 years preceding this day, their lives could not have been more different, on this day, they both encounter the power of Jesus and get a new lease on life. There is, however, one difference between their circumstances that I think is worth noting. Jairus' daughter has a powerful and earnest advocate in the person of her father. The woman has no one to speak for her. And in the first instance, she doesn't dare declare her presence or her problem. So what does this account tell us about Jesus' heart towards us? Notice in verse 30 that Jesus is the one who interrupts the flow of his own day when he realizes that someone has reached out and touched him. I think that this choice on Jesus' part reveals an important truth. When Jesus' power is released to address our problems, sickness, financial need, emotional brokenness, whatever it is. It is released in order to create personal, meaningful, and long-lasting connections with us. In other words, encounters with Jesus are intended to be person to person, not just power to problem. He's not simply interested in building up an extensive CV of impressive healing and miracle-based achievements. He's passionate about changing whole lives. He takes time to stop and listen, to attend to the individual. As I observe Jesus' behavior, it makes me stop and reflect on the way that I relate to and connect with the people in my life. Do I stop and take time to listen and attend to the individual? See, I have access to lots of information about the people in my life via social media platforms. You know, I have the option of investing in a lot of time in building my own reputation. You know, you can have a whole mini PR campaign via social media. You know, building up your Facebook status, posting smiley pictures. But if you want to know how I'm really doing, don't check my Facebook page. Because there you'll find a constructed reality, not the substance of my life. We have so many tools to connect with each other, but we have less time to do so. So the way we use our time is important. I wanted to share a short testimony about how someone in this church community really used their time, invested their time in me. As Elliot mentioned, I'm involved in a group called Barney's, which is a toddler group that meets on a Wednesday and Friday here. I helped to coordinate that group on a Friday. And Barney's is really organized chaos. You know, lots of new parents who can really relate to that first image that I showed you where it's like, what is going on in my life? But one day, as we were singing the nursery rhymes, I had a snatched conversation with Liz Bewley, who used to be our youth pastor here at St. Bee's. And just for a moment, I think God just chose that moment. God opened my heart, and something that I said showed to Liz that I was feeling particularly broken that day. I'd just gotten to this point where, for many reasons, I was lonely and frustrated, and I felt that, I think the nub of it was I felt that I had failed as a Christian, that I wasn't, the things that I believed that God was going to do in my life, I just wasn't seeing them happen, and I felt really bereft of that vision that I thought that God had for my life. And actually, until that moment, I don't think I had tuned into how I was feeling. But just in a snatched conversation between nursery rhymes, Liz heard something that I said. I said to her, I just feel that I'm a failed Christian. What was her response to that? She could have just said, oh, that was a funny thing Jeanette said. Why did she say that? But no, but after we finished singing, Here We Go Around the Mulberry Bush, she came back to me. Liz looked me in the eye and she said, Jeanette, I need to say something to you. I need to tell you that what you have just said to me is not true. I could have walked away, but I just felt that God wanted me to tell you that. That made such a difference to me. But guess what? That wasn't all she did. She went on to open up her life to me. She gave me the gift of some of her time. In the middle of an incredibly busy life, both of us had very busy lives. She was youth pastor here, and she's a mom of two, under fives. But over the next few weeks and months, there were snatched lunches and coffees and texts and phone calls and quick prayers. And God used that friendship and a number of other encounters to heal and restore a part of me that had been badly damaged. A part of me I didn't even realize had been badly damaged. In my perception of myself before God, in my perception of who I was as someone who belonged to God, I had forgotten how precious I was. And that friendship made a difference. And that was just because Liz took time to be my friend. What a gift. So let's look back at what Jesus does in this passage. Let's look back at his behavior. How does he use his time and his influence on behalf of the woman who has no one to speak up for herself? Well, Jesus asks what seems to be a nonsensical question. Who touched my clothes in the middle of a crowd? But in this moment, he's not interested in saving face or sticking to the day's agenda. He's interested in the specific person who has encountered his power. He doesn't check what time it is or stop to apologize to Jairus, who obviously has an urgent need. He interrupts the flow of the day's activities to focus on the woman. Let me share an excerpt from a commentary by an American theologian called Steve Wilmerhurst about how desperate this woman would have been. Here goes. A woman like this is in trouble for no less than five reasons. Firstly, it's embarrassing, not so much because people are coy, as because it would make them despise her. She lives with constant shame. Secondly, it's physically so debilitating. She lives with constant weakness. Thirdly, her desperate attempts to find a cure have driven her into poverty. With this condition, she'd be poor anyway, but tragically, she has spent her last reserves on hopeless remedies. Fourthly, she'll be physically unable to have children, with the bitter disappointment and shame that would bring in a culture where the family line is all important. But perhaps worse than any of these, fifthly, she will be ritually unclean all the time. The Jewish law is very clear on these matters. The Jewish scholars typically produced a whole book of rules about how someone like this had to live. It's there in the Talmud. No one who wants to worship can touch her. She herself can never approach the presence of God, can never enter the temple courts to pray. She is a permanent outcast. So we see from this quote how much this woman needed an intervention on many levels. Let's observe how Jesus responds. Jesus creates an opportunity for the woman's reputation to be restored. He goes out of his way to ensure that her healing is publicly recognized. In verse 32, Jesus takes time to listen to the woman's entire story. There's no indication of how long it took her to tell her story, but she got the opportunity to tell him the whole truth, and he gave her the time to do that. Jesus gives the woman public verbal affirmation. This would have gone a long way in building her personal confidence and her public credibility. She has her whole life to rebuild. Jesus gives her a solid foundation so she can make a confident start. As we look on at Jesus' choice, what is he saying to us about the way that we should live our lives? How should we use the gift of our time? When the flow of our days or the flow of our lives is interrupted by real people with real needs to be addressed, how can we become more like Jesus in this regard? Jesus stops and gives this woman the gift of his time and transforms his life, her life, sorry. But what about Jairus? What about his daughter? I can't help but wonder what he might have been thinking as the episode with the woman unfolded. The writer John Mark doesn't give us any insight into what Jairus is saying. He must have had this whole spectrum of emotions. That's great, isn't it? In verse 35, we read that as he waits for Jesus to turn his attention back to his daughter's situation, he feels a tap on the shoulder. Jairus, listen. Don't waste any more time. Your daughter is dead. Then after all this has happened, the seemingly unnecessary and epic delay, Jesus comes out with the most unbelievable statement. Do not be afraid. Just believe. In this account, this is the first record of Jesus directly addressing Jairus. Perhaps this statement speaks to the heart of what Jairus has been feeling throughout this entire rollercoaster of emotions. Perhaps here, once again, we see Jesus taking a moment to be personal, addressing Jairus person to person, reassuring him that there is still more than sufficient power to address his problem. Besides, why would Jesus have come with him if he intended to abandon him halfway through the process? Here's another observation. Even as Jairus waited in the queue, he was still in the presence of Jesus and was witness to the healing and restoration of the woman. Which part of Jairus' heart was Jesus touching by giving him access to this encounter? I don't think it's a stretch of the imagination to say that in years to come, this entire episode would continue to have an impact on Jairus' life. He'd be able to say, yes, it was an awesome day. He healed my daughter. He brought her back from the life. But do you know the lady who lives on the corner? You should hear her story. Maybe this is an important message for someone here today or listening to this message on the podcast. Has your situation moved from ill to dying to dead? Even though you pleaded earnestly with God to do something about it? Perhaps Jesus wants to say to you, person to person, I'm still in control, even when it doesn't look that way, even when it appears that there is no more reason to hold out hope. Give me your immediate need. Don't be afraid. Just believe. And while you're waiting, open your eyes to what I'm doing around you. Your story and the stories of those around you are like pieces of a puzzle that help you to know and understand me in a deeper way. So come on, Jairus. Let's continue our journey together. While you're still with me, there's still hope. Let's go wake up your sleeping daughter. We know things have become personal with Jairus because in verse 37, Jesus sheds the crowd and the wider circle of disciples. And he brings with him only his closest companions, Peter, James, and John. As he arrives at Jairus' home, he makes another PR faux pas. There's a group of mourners outside, sobbing loudly, and Jesus starts talking like a crazy person, saying the girl is sleeping when she's obviously dead. But in verse 40, he closes the circle of intimacy again by sending everyone out except the girl's father and mother, and his inner circle. There's no formal laying on of hands here, no poetic declarations. In verses 41 to 42, Jesus takes her by the hand. This is personal. And he simply says, little girl, I say to you, get up. A bit like when I wake my little one in the morning. That's if he doesn't wake up before me. Not like when I put him to bed at night. There's no drama. You know, it's just a simple, gentle exchange between Jesus and the little girl. Simple, reassuringly calm encounter. Get up, little girl. Are you ready for something to eat? You know, earlier we were singing Come and Wake Us in the worship. You know, when Jesus wants to wake us up to the reality of who he is, it's a simple and gentle encounter sometimes. Wake up. Are you ready for something to eat? She must have been incredibly groggy, you know, waking up from death. She rubs her eyes, gives her mom and dad a cuddle, and then becomes aware of the intense hunger pangs in her tummy. This is personal. Jesus tells them to keep it all confidential. And by the way, she's starving. Could you give her something to eat? So what can we take from these stories? What has Jesus demonstrated about his heart towards us? I believe that above and beyond the amazing power that Jesus displays throughout this series of encounters, he displays a profound desire for intimacy with the people he meets. He meets them person to person, not just power to problem. To the anonymous woman, he says, "You are not just a faceless statistic." To Jairus, he says, "Do not be afraid, just believe. Let's continue our journey together." To his inner circle of disciples, he says, "Stay close to me, and I will reveal to you that I am deliberately and deeply compassionate in individual lives and circumstances, to the tiniest detail." To the little girl, he says, "Take my hand. Here is your life back. Are you ready for something to eat?" And to all of us, he says, "When I heal you, restore you, provide for you, protect you, it's personal." Can I ask the band to come back up? How can we respond to this? Do we just need to stop, put our set agendas aside, and meet with Jesus? Do we need to make ourselves known to Jesus, open our hearts, and take time to tell him the whole truth? Then he can fully restore us. This morning, I want to encourage you not to slip away, but to stay for a while and maybe share what God is doing in your life and in your heart with a member of the prayer team, maybe. Or just linger for a while in his presence. Perhaps we can't make sense of the place we found ourselves in, and we need reassurance that we're not alone, that we can draw close to God, and that he can walk with us through our doubts and fears, because he's more than able to meet our needs. And even in this place of uncertainty, is Jesus showing us how he's working in someone else's life? Can we open our hearts to how this knowledge of God's work in someone else's life might build our faith and encourage us to lean on him? Or maybe there's a lesson for the way that we relate to the people in our lives. Do we need to use our time, money, power, or influence to advocate for someone who doesn't have a voice of their own, someone who's faceless? Do we ever make other people's needs or personal concern? When Jesus heals you, restores you, provides for you, protects you, it's personal. And now it's our time to respond. I'm going to pray.